When she's not getting enough, she starts her little girl act. Don't leave me alone, Jasper. I get scared when you're not here at night. Telling stupid lies. Funny phone calls to the house. Men hiding in the flower beds, fiddling with the horses. What? Said Raphael, half laughing. But Izzy cut him short. Oh, Christ, look. Papa's left his briefing papers. She hurried out from behind her desk, snatched a leather folder off the top of the radiator, and called over her shoulder, "Raph, you can listen to the phone messages and transcribe them for me while I'm gone, okay?" The heavy wooden door thudded shut behind her, leaving Robin and Raphael alone. If she had been hyper-aware of Raphael before Izzy had gone, now he seemed to Robin to fill the entire room, his olive dark eyes on her. He took ecstasy and ran his car into a mother of a four-year-old. He barely served a third of his sentence, and now his father's put him on the taxpayer's payroll.
"How do I do this, then?"
asked Raphael, moving behind Izzy's desk. "Just press play, I expect," Robin muttered, sipping her coffee and pretending to make notes on a pad. Canned messages began to issue from the answering machine, drowning out the faint hum of conversation from the terrace beyond the net-curtained window. A man named Rupert asked Izzy to call him back about the AGM. A constituent called Mrs. Ricketts spoke for 2 solid minutes about traffic along the Banbury Road. An irate woman said crossly that she ought to have expected an answering machine, and that MPs ought to be answering to the public personally, then spoke until cut off by the machine about her neighbour's failure to lop overhanging branches from a tree, in spite of repeated requests from the council. Then a man's growl, almost theatrically menacing, filled the quiet office.
"They say they piss themselves as they die, Chisel. Is that true? 40 grand. Or I'll find out how much the papers will pay."
Chapter 20. We two have worked our way forward in complete companionship. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. Strike had selected the 2 chairmen for his Wednesday evening catch-up with Robin because of its proximity to the Palace of Westminster. The pub was tucked away on a junction of centuries-old back streets, Old Queen Street, Cockpit Steps, amid a motley collection of quaint, sedate buildings that stood at oblique angles to each other. Only as he limped across the road and saw the hanging metal sign over the front door did Strike realise that the 2 chairmen, for whom the pub was named, were not, as he had assumed, joint managers of a board, but lowly servants carrying the heavy load of a sedan chair. Tired and sore as Strike was, the image seemed appropriate, although the occupant of the sedan chair in the pub sign was a refined lady in white, not a large, curmudgeonly minister with wiry hair and a short temper. The bar was crowded with after-work drinkers, and Strike had a sudden apprehension that he might not get a seat inside, an unwelcome prospect because leg, back and neck were tight and sore after yesterday's long drive and the hours he had spent in Harley Street today watching Dodgy Doc. Strike had just bought a pint of London Pride when the table by the window became free. With a turn of speed born of necessity, he nabbed the high bench with its back to the street before the nearest group of suited men and women could annex it. There was no question of anybody challenging his right to sole occupancy of a table made for 4. Strike was large enough and surly enough in appearance to make even this group of civil servants doubt their ability to negotiate a compromise. The wooden-floored bar was what Strike mentally categorized as upmarket utilitarian. A faded mural on the back wall depicted bewigged 18th-century men gossiping together, but otherwise all was pared-back wood and monochrome prints. He peered out of the window to see whether Robin was within sight. But as there was no sign of her, he drank his beer, read the day's news on his phone, and tried to ignore the menu lying on the table in front of him, which was taunting him with a picture of battered fish. Robin, who had been due to arrive at 6, was still absent at 5:30. Unable to resist the picture on the menu any longer, Strike ordered himself cod and chips and a 2nd pint, and read a long article in the Times about the upcoming Olympics opening ceremony, which was really a long list of the ways in which the journalist feared it might misrepresent and humiliate the nation. By 7:15, Strike was starting to worry about Robin. He had just decided to call her when she came hurrying in through the door, flushed, wearing glasses that Strike knew she did not need, and with an expression that he recognised as the barely contained excitement of one who has something worthwhile to impart.
"Hazel eyes," he noted, as she sat down opposite him. "Good one. Changes your whole look. What have you got?"
"How do you know I've..." "Well, loads, actually," she said, deciding it was not worthwhile toying with him. "I nearly called you earlier, but there have been people around all day, and I had a close shave this morning placing the listening device."
"You did it. Bloody well done."
"Thanks. I really want a drink. Hang on." She came back with a glass of red wine and launched immediately into an account of the message that Raphael had found on the answering machine that morning. "I had no chance of getting the caller's number, because there were four messages after it. The phone system's antiquated."
Frowning, Strike asked, "How did the caller pronounce Chiswell? Can you remember?"
"They said it right, Chisel."
"Fits with Jimmy," said Strike. "What happened after the call?"
"Raph told Izzy about it when she got back to the office," said Robin. And Strike thought he detected a touch of self-consciousness as she said the name Raph. He didn't understand what he was passing on, obviously. Izzy called her dad straight away and he went berserk. We could hear him shouting on the end of the line, though not much of what he was actually saying.
Strike stroked his chin, thinking. "What did the anonymous caller sound like?"
"London accent," Robin said. "Threatening."
"They piss themselves as they die," repeated Strike in an undertone.
There was something that Robin wanted to say, but a brutal personal memory made it hard for her to articulate.
"Strangling victims, yeah," said Strike, cutting her off. "I know."
Both of them drank. "Well, assuming the call was Jimmy," Robin went on, "he's phoned the department twice today." She opened her handbag and showed Strike the listening device hidden inside it.
"You retrieved it?" he asked, staggered.
"And replaced it with another one," said Robin, unable to suppress a triumphant smile. "That's why I'm late. I took a chance. Amir, who worked with Wynne, left, and Geraint came into our office while I was packing up to chat me up."
"He did he?" asked Strike, amused.
"I'm glad you find it funny," said Robin coolly. "He isn't a nice man."
"Sorry," said Strike. "In what way is he not a nice man?"
"Just take it from me," said Robin. "I've met plenty of them in offices. He's a pervert, but with creepy add-ons." "He was just telling me," she said, and her indignation showed in the rising tide of pink in her face, "that I reminded him of his dead daughter. Then he touched my hair."
"Touched your hair?" repeated Strike, unamused.
"Picked a bit of it off my shoulder and ran it through his fingers," said Robin. "Then I think he saw what I thought of him and tried to pass it off as fatherly. Anyway, I said I needed the loo, but asked him to stay put so we could keep chatting about charities. I nipped down the corridor and swapped the devices."
"That was bloody good going, Robin."
"I'll listen to it on the way here," said Robin, pulling headphones out of her pocket, and... Robin handed Strike the headphones. "I've queued up the interesting bit." Strike obediently inserted the earbuds, and Robin switched on the tape in her handbag.
"At 3:30, Amir."
The Welsh male voice was interrupted by the sound of a mobile phone ringing. Feet scuffled near the PowerPoint. The ring ceased, and Geraint said,
"Oh, hello, Jimmy. Half a more. Amir, close that door."
More scuffling footsteps.
"Jimmy, yes?"
There followed a long stretch in which Geraint seemed to be attempting to stem the flow of a mounting tirade.
"Whoa, now wait, Jimmy, listen. I know you've lost out, Jimmy, I understand how bitter. Jimmy, please. We understand your feelings. That's unfair, Jimmy. Neither Della nor I grew up with. My father was a coal miner, Jimmy. Now listen, please. We're close to getting the pictures.
There followed a spell in which Strike thought he heard, very faintly, the rise and fall of Jimmy Knight's fluent speech at the end of the telephone.
"I take your point," said Geraint finally, "but I urge you to do nothing rash, Jimmy. He isn't going to give you... Jimmy, listen. He isn't going to give you your money. He's made that perfectly clear. It's the newspapers now or nothing. So, proof, Jimmy. Proof."
Another shorter period of unintelligible gabbling followed.
"I've just told you, haven't I?" "Yes. No, but the Foreign Office..." "Well, hardly. No. Amir has a contact. Yes, yes, all right, then. I will, Jimmy. Good. Yes, all right. Yes. Goodbye."
The clunk of a mobile being set down was followed by Geraint's voice.
"Stupid prick," he said.
There were more footsteps. Strike glanced at Robin, who, by a rolling gesture of the hand, indicated that he should keep listening. After about 30 seconds, Amir spoke, diffident and strained.
"Geraint, Christopher didn't promise anything about the pictures."
Even on the tinny little tape, with the nearby shufflings of paper at Geraint's desk, the silence sounded charged.
"Geraint, did you—"
"Yes, I heard," snapped Wynne.
"Good God, boy. A first from the LSE, and you can't think of a way to persuade that bastard to give you pictures. I'm not asking you to take them out of the department, just to get copies. That shouldn't be beyond the wit of man."
"I don't want more trouble," muttered Amir.
"Well, I should have thought," said Geraint, "after everything Della in particular has done for you."
"And I'm grateful," said Amir swiftly. "You know I am. All right, I'll try."
For the next minute there were no sounds but scuffing footsteps and papers, followed by a mechanical click. The device automatically switched off after a minute of no talking, activated again when somebody spoke. The next voice was that of a different man asking whether Della would be attending the subcommittee this afternoon. Strike removed the earbuds.
"Did you catch it all?" Robin asked.
"I think so," said Strike.
She leaned back, watching Strike expectantly.
"The Foreign Office," he repeated quietly. "What the hell can he have done that means the Foreign Office has got pictures?"
"I thought we weren't supposed to be interested in what he did," said Robin, eyebrows raised.
"I never said I wasn't interested, just that I'm not being paid to find out."
Strike's fish and chips arrived. He thanked the barmaid and proceeded to add a generous amount of ketchup to his plate.
"Izzy was completely matter-of-fact about whatever it is," said Robin, thinking back. "She couldn't possibly have spoken about it the way she did if he'd, you know, murdered anybody."
She deliberately avoided the word strangled. 3 panic attacks in 3 days were quite sufficient.
"Got to say," said Strike, now chewing chips, "that anonymous call makes you..."
"Unless," he said, struck by a thought, "Jimmy's had the bright idea of trying to drag Chisel into the Billy business on top of whatever else he's genuinely done. A child killing doesn't have to be true to make trouble for a government minister who's already got the press on his tail. You know the internet. Plenty of people out there think being a Tory is tantamount to being a child killer. This might be Jimmy's idea of adding pressure."
Strike stabbed a few chips moodily with his fork.
"I'd be glad to know where Billy is, if we had somebody free to look for him. Barclay hasn't seen any sign of him, and says Jimmy hasn't mentioned having a brother."
"Billy said he was being held captive,"
Robin said tentatively.
"Don't think we can set much store on anything Billy's saying right now, to be honest. I knew a guy in the Shiners who had a psychotic episode on exercises. Thought he had cockroaches living under his skin."
"In the
Shiners, Fusiliers. Want a chip?"
"I better not," sighed Robin, though she was hungry.
Matthew, whom she had warned by text that she would be late, had told her he would wait for her to get home so they could eat dinner together.
"Listen, I haven't told you everything."
"Suki Lewis?" asked Strike, hopefully.
"I haven't been able to work her into the conversation yet. No, it's that Chisel's wife claims men have been lurking in the flower beds and fiddling with her horses."
"Men?" Strike repeated. "In the plural?"
"That's what Izzy said. But she also says Kinvara's hysterical and attention-seeking."
"Getting to be a bit of a theme, that, isn't it? People are supposed to be too crazy to know what they've seen."
"Do you think that could have been Jimmy as well, in the garden?"
Strike thought it over as he chewed.
"I can't see what he's got to gain from lurking in the garden or fiddling with horses, unless he's at the point where he just wants to frighten Chisel. I'll check with Barclay and see whether Jimmy's got a car or mention going to Oxfordshire. Did Kinvara call the police?"
"Raff asked that when Izzy got back," said Robin, and once again Strike thought he detected a trace of self-consciousness as she spoke the man's name. "Kinvara claims the dogs barked. She saw the shadow of a man in the garden, but he ran away. She says there were footprints in the horse's field next morning, and that one of them had been cut with a knife."
"Did she call a vet?"
"I don't know. It's harder to ask questions with Raff in the office. I don't want to look too nosy, because he doesn't know who I am."
Strike pushed his plate away from him and felt for his cigarettes.
"Photos," he mused, returning to the central point. "Photos at the Foreign Office. What the hell can they show that would incriminate Chisel? He's never worked at the Foreign Office, has he?"
"No," said Robin. "The highest post he's ever held is Minister for Trade. He had to resign from there because of the affair with Raff's mother."
The wooden clock over the fireplace was telling her it was time to leave. She didn't move.
"You're liking Raff, then?" Strike said suddenly, catching her off guard.
"What?"
Robin was scared that she had blushed.
"What do you mean? I'm liking him."
"Just an impression I got," said Strike. "You disapproved of him before you met him."
"Do you want me to be antagonistic towards him, when I'm supposed to be his father's goddaughter?" demanded Robin.
"No, of course not," said Strike,
though Robin had the sense that he was laughing at her and resented it.
"I'd better get going," she said, sweeping the headphones off the table and back into her bag. "I told Matt I'd be home for dinner."
She got up, bade Strike goodbye, and left the pub. Strike watched her go, dimly sorry that he had commented on her manner when mentioning Raphael Chisel. After a few minutes' solitary beer consumption, he paid for his food and ambled out onto the pavement, where he lit a cigarette and called the Minister for Culture, who answered on the second ring.
"Wait there," said Chisel.
Strike could hear a murmuring crowd behind him.
"Crowded room."
The clunk of a door closing and the noise of the crowd was muted.
"I'm at a dinner," said Chisel. "Anything for me?" "It isn't good news, I'm afraid," said Strike,
walking away from the pub up Queen Anne Street, between white-painted buildings that gleamed in the dusk.
"My partner succeeded in planting the listening device in Mr. Wynne's office this morning. We've got a recording of him talking to Jimmy Knight. Wynne's assistant, Amir, is it, is trying to get copies of these photographs you told me about, at the Foreign Office."
The ensuing silence lasted so long that Strike wondered whether they had been cut off.
"Minister, I'm here," snarled Chisel. "That boy Malik, is it? Dirty little bastard. He's already lost one job. Let him try, that's all. Let him try. Does he think I won't? I know things about Amir Malik," he said. "Oh, yes."
Strike waited in some surprise for elucidation of these remarks, but none were forthcoming. Chisel merely breathed heavily into the telephone. Soft, muffled thuds told Strike that Chisel was pacing up and down on carpet.
"Is that all you had to say to me?" demanded the MP at last.
"There was one other thing," said Strike. "My partner says your wife's seen a man or men trespassing on your property at night."
"Oh," said Chisel. "Yes."
He did not sound particularly concerned.
My wife keeps horses and she takes their security very seriously.
You don't think this has any connection with...
Not in the slightest, not in the slightest. Kinvara sometimes. Well, to be candid, said Chisel, she can be bloody hysterical. Keeps a bunch of horses always fretting they're going to be stolen. I don't want you wasting time chasing shadows through the undergrowth in Oxfordshire. My problems are in London. Is that everything?
Strike said that it was, and after a curt farewell, Chisel hung up, leaving Strike to limp towards St. James's Park station. Settled in a corner seat of the tube 10 minutes later, Strike folded his arms, stretched out his legs, and stared unseeingly at the window opposite. The nature of this investigation was highly unusual. He had never before had a blackmail case where the client was so unforthcoming about his offence. But then, Strike reasoned with himself, he had never had a government minister as a client before. Equally, it was not every day that a possibly psychotic young man burst into Strike's office and insisted that he had witnessed a child murder, though Strike had certainly received his fair share of unusual and unbalanced communications since hitting the newspapers. What he had once called, over Robin's occasional protests, the nutter drawer, now filled half a filing cabinet. It was the precise relationship between the strangled child and Chisel's case of blackmail that was preoccupying Strike, even though, on the face of it, the connection was obvious. It lay in the fact of Jimmy and Billy's brotherhood. Now somebody, and Strike thought it overwhelmingly likely to be Jimmy, judging from Robin's account of the call, seemed to have decided to tie Billy's story to Chisel, even though the blackmailable offence that had brought Chisel to Strike could not possibly have been infanticide, or Geraint Wynne would have gone to the police. Like a tongue probing a pair of ulcers, Strike's thoughts kept returning fruitlessly to the Knight brothers. Jimmy, charismatic, articulate, thuggishly good-looking, a chancer and a hothead, and Billy, haunted, filthy, unquestionably ill, bedevilled by a memory no less dreadful for the fact that it might be false.
They piss themselves as they die.
Who did? Again, Strike seemed to hear Billy Knight.
They buried her in a pink blanket down in the dell by my dad's house. But afterwards they said it was a boy.
He had just been specifically instructed by his client to restrict his investigations to London, not Oxfordshire. As he checked the name of the station at which they had just arrived, Strike remembered Robin's self-consciousness when talking about Raphael Chisel. Yawning, he took out his mobile again and succeeded in Googling the youngest of his client's offspring, of whom there were many pictures going up the courtroom steps to his trial for manslaughter. As he scrolled through multiple pictures of Raphael, Strike felt a rising antipathy towards the handsome young man in his dark suit. Setting aside the fact that Chisel's son resembled an Italian model more than anything British, the images caused a latent resentment, rooted in class and personal injuries, to glow a little redder inside Strike's chest. Raphael was of the same type as Jago Ross, the man whom Charlotte had married after splitting with Strike. Upper class, expensively clothed and educated, their peccadilloes treated more leniently for being able to afford the best lawyers, for resembling the sons of judges deciding their fates. The train set off again, and Strike, losing his connection, stuffed his phone back into his pocket, folded his arms, and resumed his blank stare at the dark window, trying to deny an uncomfortable idea headspace, but it nosed up against him like a dog demanding food, impossible to ignore. He now realized that he had never imagined Robin being interested in any man other than Matthew, except, of course, for that moment when he himself had held her on the stairs at her wedding, when, briefly. Angry with himself, he kicked the unhelpful thought aside and forced his wandering mind back onto the curious case of a government minister, slashed horses, and a body buried in a pink blanket, down in a dell.
Chapter 21 Certain games are going on behind your back in this house. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm.
Why are you so busy and I've got bugger all to do? Raphael asked Robin, late on Friday morning.
She had just returned from tailing Geraint to Portcullis House. Observing him from a distance, she had seen how the polite smiles of the many young women he greeted turned to expressions of dislike as he passed. Geraint had disappeared into a meeting room on the first floor, so Robin had returned to Izzy's office. Approaching Geraint's room, she had hoped she might be able to slip inside and retrieve the second listening device. But through the open door, she saw Amir working at his computer.
"Raph, I'll give you something to do in a moment, babes," muttered a fraught Izzy, who was hammering at her keyboard. "I've got to finish this. It's for the local party chairwoman. Papa's coming to sign it in 5 minutes."
She threw a harried glance at her brother, who was sprawled in the armchair, his long legs spread out in front of him, shirt sleeves rolled up, tie loosened, playing with a paper visitor's pass that hung around his neck.
"Why don't you go and get yourself a coffee on the terrace?" Izzy suggested.
Robin knew she wanted him out of the way when Chisel turned up.
"Want to come for a coffee, Venetia?" asked Raphael.
"Can't," said Robin. "Busy."
The fan on Izzy's desk swept Robin's way, and she enjoyed a few seconds of cool breeze. The net curtain window gave but a misty impression of the glorious June day. Truncated parliamentarians appeared as glowing wraiths on the terrace beyond the glass. It was stuffy inside the cluttered office. Robin was wearing a cotton dress, her hair in a ponytail, but still she occasionally blotted her upper lip with the back of her hand as she pretended to be working. Having Raphael in the office was, as she had told Strike, a disadvantage. There had been no need to come up with excuses for lurking in the corridor when she had been alone with Izzy. What was more, Raphael watched her a lot, in an entirely different way to Geraint's lewd up-and-down looks. She didn't approve of Raphael, but every now and then she found herself coming perilously close to feeling sorry for him. He seemed nervy around his father, and then, well, anybody would think him handsome. That was the main reason she avoided looking at him. It was best not to, if he wanted to preserve any objectivity. He kept trying to foster a closer relationship with her, which she was attempting to discourage. Only the previous day he had interrupted her as she hovered outside Geraint's and Amir's door, listening with all her might to a conversation that Amir was having on the phone about an inquiry. From the scant details that Robin had so far heard, she was convinced that the level playing field was under discussion.
"But this isn't a statutory inquiry," Amir was asking, sounding worried. "It isn't official. I thought this was just a routine. But Mr. Wynne understood that his letter to the fundraising regulator had answered all their concerns."
Robin could not pass up the opportunity to listen, but knew her situation to be perilous. What she had not expected was to be surprised by Raphael rather than Wynne.
"What are you doing, skulking there?" he had asked, laughing.
Robin walked hastily away, but she heard Amir's door slam behind her and suspected that he, at least, would make sure that it was closed in future.
"Are you always this jumpy, or is it just me?"
Raphael had asked, hurrying after her.
"Come for a coffee, come on. I'm so bloody bored."
Robin had declined brusquely, but even as she pretended to be busy again, she had to admit that part of her, a tiny part, was flattered by his attentions. There was a knock on the door, and to Robin's surprise, Amir Malik entered the room, holding a list of names. Nervous but determined, he addressed Izzy.
Hi. Geraint would like to add the level playing field trustees to the Paralympian reception on the 12th of July, he said.
I've got nothing to do with that reception, snapped Izzy. DCMS are organising it, not me.
Why? She erupted, wiping her sweaty fringe off her forehead. Does everyone come to me?
Geraint needs him to come, said Amir,
The list of names quivered in his hand. Robin wondered whether she dared creep into Amir's empty office right now and swap the listening devices. She got to her feet quietly, trying not to draw attention to herself.
"Why doesn't he ask Della?"
asked Izzy. "Della's busy. It's only 8 people," said Amir. "He really needs..."
"Hear the word of Lachesis, the daughter of necessity."
The Minister for Culture's booming tones preceded him into the room. Chisel stood in the doorway, wearing a crumpled suit and blocking Robin's exit. She sat down quietly again. Amir, or so it seemed to Robin, braced himself.
"Know who Lachesis was, Mr. Malik?"
asked Chisel.
"Can't say I do," said Amir.
"No, I didn't study the Greeks in your Haringey comprehensive. You seem to have time in your hands, Raff. Teach Mr. Malik about Lachesis."
"I don't know either," said Raphael, peering up at his father through his thick, dark lashes.
"Playing stupid, eh? Lachesis," said Chisel, "was one of the fates. She measured out each man's allotted lifespan, knew when everyone's number would be up. Not a fan of Plato, Mr. Malik. Catullus more up your street, I expect. He produced some fine poetry about men of your habits. Pedicabo ego vos et irimabo, Aurelia pathike et canedi furi, eh? Poem 16, look it up, you'll enjoy it."
Raphael and Izzy were both staring at their father. Amir stood for a few seconds, as though he had forgotten what he had come for, then stalked out of the room.
"A little classics education for everyone," said Chisel, turning to watch him go with what appeared to be malicious satisfaction. "We are never too old to learn, eh, Raff?"
Robin's mobile vibrated on her desk. Strike had texted. They had agreed not to contact each other during working hours unless it was urgent. She slid the phone into her bag.
"Where's my signing pile?" Chisel asked Izzy. "Have you finished that letter for Brenda Bloody Bailey?"
"Printing it now," said Izzy.
While Chisel scribbled his signature on a stack of letters, breathing like a bulldog in the otherwise quiet room, Robin muttered something about needing to get going and hurried out into the corridor. Wanting to read Strike's text without fear of interruption, she followed a wooden sign to the crypt, hastened down the narrow stone staircase indicated, and found at the bottom a deserted chapel. The crypt was decorated like a medieval jewel casket, every inch of gold wall embellished with motifs and symbols, heraldic and religious. There were jewel-bright saints' pictures above the altar, and the sky-blue organ pipes were wrapped in gold ribbon and scarlet fleur-de-lis. Robin hurried into a red velvet pew and opened Strike's text. "Need a favour. Barclay's done a 10-day stretch on Jimmy Knight, but he's just found out his wife's got to work over the weekend, and he can't get anyone else to look after the baby. Andy leaves for a week in Alicante with the family tonight. I can't tail Jimmy, he knows me. Corps are joining an anti-missile march tomorrow. Starts at 2, in Bow. Can you do it?" Robin contemplated the message for several seconds, then let out a groan that echoed around the crypt. It was the first time in over a year that Strike had asked her to work extra hours at such short notice. But this was her anniversary weekend. The pricey hotel was booked, the bags packed and ready in the car. She was supposed to be meeting Matthew after work in a couple of hours. They were to drive straight to Le Manoir aux Quatre Saisons. Matthew would be furious if she said she couldn't go. In the gilded hush of the crypt, the words Strike had said to her when he had agreed to give her detective training came back to her.
"I need someone who can work long hours, weekends. You've got a lot of aptitude for the job, but you're getting married to someone who hates you doing it."
And she had told him that it didn't matter what Matthew thought, that it was up to her what she did. Where did her allegiance lie now? She had said that she would stay in the marriage, promised to give it a chance. Strike had had many hours of unpaid overtime out of her. He could not claim that she was work-shy. Slowly, deleting words, replacing them, overthinking every syllable, she typed out a response. "I'm really sorry, but it's my anniversary weekend. We've got a hotel booked, leaving this evening." She wanted to write more, but what was there to say? My marriage isn't going well, so it's important I celebrate it. I'd much rather disguise myself as a protester and stalk Jimmy Knight. She pressed send. Still waiting for his response, feeling as though she were about to get the results of medical tests, Robin's eyes followed the course of twisting vines that covered the ceiling. Strange faces peered down at her out of the moulding, like the wild green man of myth. Heraldic and pagan imagery mingled with angels and crosses. It was more than a place of God, this chapel. It harked back to an age of superstition, magic and feudal power. The minutes slid by, and still Strike hadn't answered. Robin got up and walked around the chapel. At the very back, she found a cupboard. Opening it, she saw a plaque to suffragette Emily Davison. Apparently she had slept there overnight so that she could give her place of residence as the House of Commons of the Census of 1911, 7 years before women were given the vote. Emily Davison, she could not help but feel, would not have approved of Robin's choice to place a failing marriage above freedom to work. Robin's mobile buzzed again. She looked down, afraid of what she was going to read. Strike had answered with two letters. Okay. A lead weight seemed to slide from her chest to her stomach. Strike, as she was well aware, was still living in the glorified bedsit over the office and working through weekends. The only unmarried person at the agency, the boundary between his professional and private lives was, if not precisely non-existent, then flexible and porous, whereas hers, Barclays and Hutchins, were not. And the worst of it was that Robin could think of no way of telling Strike that she was sorry, that she understood, that she wished things were different, without reminding both of them of that hug on the stairs at her wedding, now so long unmentioned that she wondered whether he even remembered it. Feeling utterly miserable, she retraced her steps out of the crypt, still holding the papers she had been pretending to deliver. Raphael was alone in the office when she returned, sitting at Izzy's PC and typing at a third of her speed. "Izzy's gone with Dad to do something so tedious it just bounced off my brain," he said. "They'll be back in a bit." Robin forced a smile, returned to her desk, her mind on Strike. "Bit weird, that poem, wasn't it?" Raphael asked.
"What? Oh, that Latin thing, yes," said Robin. "It was, a bit.
It was like he'd memorized it to use on Malik. Nobody's got that at their fingertips." Reflecting that Strike seemed to know strange bits of Latin off by heart too, Robin said,
"No, you wouldn't think so."
"Has he got it in for that Malik or something?"
"I don't really know," lied Robin.
Running out of ways to occupy her time at the desk, she shuffled papers again.
"How long are you staying, Venetia?" "I'm not sure. Until Parliament goes into recess, probably."
"You seriously want to work here, permanently?"
"Yes," she said. "I think it's interesting."
"What were you doing before this?"
"PR," said Robin. "It was quite fun, but I fancied a change."
"Hoping to bag an MP," he said, with a faint smile.
"I can't say I've seen anyone round here I'd like to marry," said Robin.
"Hurtful," said Raphael, with a mock sigh. Afraid that she had blushed, Robin tried to cover up by bending down to open a drawer and taking a few objects out at random. "So is Venetia Hall seeing anyone?" he persisted, as she straightened up.
"Yes," she said. "His name's Tim. We've been together a year now."
"Yeah? What does Tim do?"
"He works at Christie's," said Robin.
She had got the idea from the men she had seen with Sarah Shadlock in The Red Lion. Immaculate, suited public school types of the kind she imagined Chisel's goddaughter would know.
"What about you?" she asked. "Izzy said something..."
"At the gallery," said Raphael, cutting her off. "That was nothing. She was too young for me. Her parents have sent her to Florence now, anyway." He had swung his chair around to face her, his expression grave and searching, contemplating her as though he wanted to know something that common conversation would not yield. Robin broke their mutual gaze. Holding a look that intense was not compatible with being the contented girlfriend of the imaginary Tim. "Do you believe in redemption?" The question caught Robin totally by surprise. It had a kind of gravity and beauty, like the gleaming jewel of the chapel at the foot of a winding stair.
Yes, I do," she said.
He had picked up a pencil from Izzy's desk. His long fingers turned it over and over as he watched her intently. He seemed to be sizing her up.
"You know what I did?
In the car?"
"Yes,"
she answered. The silence that unspooled between them seemed to Robin to be peopled with flashing lights and shadowy figures. She could imagine Raphael bloody at the steering wheel, and the broken figure of the young mother on the road, and the police cars, and the incident tape, and the gawpers in passing cars. He was watching her intently, hoping, she thought, for some kind of benison, as though her forgiveness mattered. And sometimes she knew the kindness of a stranger, or even a casual acquaintance, could be transformative, something to cling to while those closest to you dragged you under in their efforts to help. She thought of the elderly steward in the members' lobby, uncomprehending but immensely consoling, his hoarse, kindly words a thread to hold on to, which would lead her back to sanity. The door opened again. Both Robin and Raphael jumped up as a curvy redhead entered the room, a visitor's pass hanging around her neck on a lanyard. Robin recognized her at once from online photographs as Jasper Chisel's wife, Kinvara.
"Hello,"
said Robin, because Kinvara was merely staring blankly at Raphael, who had swung hastily back to his computer and began typing again.
"You must be Venetia,"
said Kinvara, switching her clear golden gaze onto Robin. She had a high-pitched, girlish voice. Her eyes were cat-like in a slightly puffy face.
"Aren't you pretty? Nobody told me you were so pretty."
Robin had no idea how to respond to this. Kinvara dropped down into the sagging chair where Raph usually sat, took off the designer sunglasses holding her long red hair off her face, and shook it loose. Her bare arms and legs were heavily freckled. The top buttons of her sleeveless green shirt dress were straining across her heavy bust.
"Whose daughter are you?"
asked Kinvara with a trace of petulance.
"Jasper didn't tell me. He doesn't tell me anything he doesn't have to tell me, actually. I'm used to it. He just said you're a goddaughter."
Nobody had warned Robin that Kinvara did not know who she really was. Perhaps Izzy and Chisel had not expected them to come face to face.
"I'm Jonathan Hall's daughter," said Robin nervously.
She had come up with a rudimentary background for Venetia, the goddaughter, but had never expected to have to elaborate for the benefit of Chisel's own wife, who presumably knew all Chisel's friends and acquaintances.
"Who's he?"
asked Kinvara.
"I should probably know. Jasper will be cross. I haven't paid attention."
"He's in land management up in..."
"Oh, was it the Northumberland property?"
interrupted Kinvara, whose interest had not seemed particularly profound.
"That was before my time."
"Thank God," thought Robin. Kinvara crossed her legs and folded her arms across her large chest. Her foot bounced up and down. She shot Raphael a hard, almost spiteful look.
"Aren't you going to say hello, Raphael?"
"Hello," he said.
"Jasper told me to meet him here, but if you'd rather I waited in the corridor, I can,"
Kinvara said in a high, tight voice. "Of course not," muttered Raphael, frowning determinedly at his monitor.
"Well, I wouldn't want to interrupt anything,"
said Kinvara, turning from Raphael to Robin. The story of the blonde in the art gallery bathroom swam back into Robin's mind. For a second time, she pretended to be searching for something in a drawer, and it was with relief that she heard the sounds of Chisel and Izzy coming along the corridor.
"And by 10 o'clock, no later, or I won't have time to read the whole bloody thing.
And tell Haynes he'll have to talk to the BBC. I haven't got time for a bunch of idiots talking about Ginvara.
Chisel stopped dead in the office door and said, without any trace of affection,
I told you to meet me at DCMS, not here.
And it's lovely to see you too, Jasper, after 3 days apart, said Kinvara,
getting to her feet and smoothing her crumpled dress.
Hi, Kinvara, said Izzy.
I forgot you said DCMS,
Kinvara told Chisel, ignoring her stepdaughter.
I've been trying to call you all morning.
I told you, growled Chisel. I'll be in meetings till one, and if it's about those bloody stud fees again...
No, it isn't about the stud fees, Jasper, actually. And I'd have preferred to tell you in private, but if you want me to say it in front of your children, I will.
Oh, for heaven's sake! Chisel blustered. Come away, then. Come on. We'll find a private room.
There was a man last night, said Kinvara, who... Don't look at me like that, Isabella.
Izzy's expression was indeed conveying naked scepticism. She raised her eyebrows and walked into the room, acting as though Kinvara had become invisible to her.
I said you can tell me in a private room, snarled Chisel.
But Kinvara refused to be deflected.
I saw a man in the woods by the house last night, Jasper, she said,
in a loud, high-pitched voice that Robin knew would be echoing all the way along the narrow corridor.
I'm not imagining things. There was a man with a spade in the woods. I saw him, and he ran when the dogs chased him. You keep telling me not to make a fuss, but I'm alone in that house at night, and if you're not going to do anything about this, Jasper, I'm going to call the police.
Chapter 22. Don't you feel called upon to undertake it for the sake of the good cause? Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. Strike was in a thoroughly bad temper. Why the fuck, he asked himself, as he limped towards Mile End Park the following morning, was he, the senior partner and founder of the firm, having to stake out a protest march on a hot Saturday morning when he had 3 employees and a knackered leg? Because, he answered himself, he didn't have a baby who needed watching, or a wife who'd booked plane tickets or broken her wrist, or a fucking anniversary weekend planned. He wasn't married, so it was his downtime that had to be sacrificed, his weekend that became just 2 more working days. Everything that Robin feared Strike to be thinking about her, he was, in fact, thinking. Of her house on cobbled Albury Street versus his drafty 2 rooms in a converted attic. Of the rights and status conferred by the little gold ring on her finger, set against Lorelei's disappointment when he had explained that lunch, and possibly dinner, would now be impossible. Of Robin's promise of equal responsibility when he had taken her on as a partner, contrasted with the reality of her rushing home to her husband. Yes, Robin had worked many hours of unpaid overtime in her 2 years at the agency. Yes, he knew that she had gone way beyond the call of duty for him. Yes, he was, in theory, fucking grateful to her. The fact remained that today, while he was limping along the street towards hours of probably fruitless surveillance, she and her arsehole of a husband were speeding off to a country hotel weekend, a thought that made his sore leg and back no easier to bear. Unshaven, clad in an old pair of jeans, a frayed, washed-out hoodie and ancient trainers, with a carrier bag swinging from his hands, Strike entered the park. He could see the massing protesters in the distance. The risk of Jimmy recognizing him had almost decided Strike to let the march go unwatched, but the most recent text from Robin, which he had out of sheer bad temper left unanswered, had changed his mind. Kinvara Chisel came into the office. She claimed she saw a man with a spade in the woods near their house last night. From what she said, Chisel's been telling her not to call the police about these intruders, but she says she's going to do it unless he does something about them. Kinvara didn't know Chisel's called us in. By the way, she thought I really was Venetia Hall. Also, there's a chance the Charity Commission's investigating the level playing field. I'm trying to get more details. This communication had only served to aggravate Strike. Nothing short of a concrete piece of evidence against Geraint Wynne would have satisfied him right now, with the sun on Chisel's case and their client so tetchy and stressed. According to Barclay, Jimmy Knight owned a 10-year-old Suzuki Alto, but it had failed its MOT and was currently off the road. Barclay could not absolutely guarantee that Jimmy wasn't sneaking out under cover of darkness to trespass in Chisel's gardens and woods 70 miles away, but Strike thought it unlikely. On the other hand, he thought it just possible that Jimmy might have sent a proxy to intimidate Chisel's wife. He probably still had friends or acquaintances in the area where he grew up. An even more disturbing idea was that Billy had escaped from the prison, real or imaginary, in which he had told Strike he was being held, and decided to dig for proof that the child lay in a pink blanket by his father's old cottage, or, gripped by who knew what paranoid fantasy, to slash one of Kinvara's horses. Worried by these inexplicable features of the case, by the interest the son was taking in the minister, and aware that the agency was no closer to securing a bargaining chip against either of Chisel's blackmailers than on the day that Strike had accepted the minister as a client, he felt he had little choice but to leave no stone unturned. In spite of his tiredness, his aching muscles, and his strong suspicion that the protest march would yield nothing useful, he had dragged himself out of bed on Saturday morning, strapped his prosthesis back onto a stump that was already slightly puffy, and, unable to think of much he'd like to do less than walk for 2 hours, set off for Mile End Park. Once close enough to the crowd of protesters to make out individuals, Strike pulled from the carrier bag swinging from his hand a plastic Guy Fawkes mask, white with curling eyebrows and moustache, and now mainly associated with the hacking organisation Anonymous, and put it on. Balling up the carrier bag, he shoved it into a handy bin, then hobbled on towards the cluster of placards and banners. No missiles on homes, no snipers on streets, don't play games with our lives, and several He's Got to Go posters featuring the Prime Minister's face. Strike's fake foot always found grass one of the most difficult surfaces to navigate. He was sweating by the time he finally spotted the orange core banners with their logo of broken Olympic rings. There were about a dozen of them. Lurking behind a group of chattering youths, Strike readjusted the slipping plastic mask, which had not been constructed for a man whose nose had been broken, and spotted Jimmy Knight, who was talking to two young women, both of whom had just thrown back their heads, laughing delightedly at something Knight had said. Clamping the mask to his face to make sure the slits aligned with his eyes, Strike scanned the rest of the core members and concluded that the absence of tomato red hair was not because Flicker dyed it another colour, but because she wasn't there. Stewards now started herding the crowd into something resembling a line. Strike moved into the mass of protesters, a silent, lumbering figure, acting a little obtusely, so that the youthful organisers, intimidated by his size, treated him like a rock around which the current must be channelled as he took up a position right behind Core. A skinny boy who was also wearing an Anonymous mask gave Strike a double thumbs up as he was shunted towards the rear of the line. Strike returned it. Now smoking a roll-up, Jimmy continued to joke with the two young girls beside him, who were vying for his attention. The darker of the two, who was particularly attractive, was holding a double-sided banner carrying a highly detailed painting of David Cameron as Hitler, overlooking the 1936 Olympic Stadium. It was quite an impressive piece of art, and Strike had time to admire it, as the procession finally set off at a steady pace, flanked by police and stewards in high-visibility jackets, moving gradually out of the park and onto the long, straight Roman road. The smooth tarmac was slightly easier on Strike's prosthesis, but his stump was still throbbing. After a few minutes, a chant was got up, "Missiles out! Missiles out!" A couple of press photographers were walking backwards in the road ahead, taking pictures of the front of the march.
"Hey, Libby," said Jimmy to the girl with the hand-painted Hitler banner. "Want to get on my shoulders?"
Strike noted her friend's poorly concealed envy as Jimmy crouched down so that Libby could straddle his neck and be lifted up above the crowd, her banner raised high enough for the photographers in front to see.
"Show 'em your tits, we'll be front page,"
Jimmy called up to her.
"Jimmy!"
she squealed in mock outrage. Her friend's smile was forced. The cameras clicked, and Strike, grimacing with pain behind the plastic mask, tried not to limp too obviously.
"Guy with the biggest camera was focused on you the whole time," said Jimmy, when he finally lowered the girl back to the ground.
"Fuck, if I'm in the papers, my mum will go apeshit,"
said the girl excitedly, and she fell into step on Jimmy's other side, taking any opportunity to nudge or slap him as he teased her about being scared of what her parents would say. She was, Strike judged, at least 15 years younger than he was.
"Enjoying yourself, Jimmy?"
The mask restricted Strike's peripheral vision, so that it was only when the uncombed tomato-red hair appeared immediately in front of him that Strike realized Flick had joined the march. Her sudden appearance had taken Jimmy by surprise, too.
"There you are," he said, with a feeble show of pleasure.
Flick glared at the girl called Libby, who sped up, intimidated. Jimmy tried to put his arm around Flick, but she shrugged it off.
"Oi,"
he said, feigning innocent indignation.
"What's up?"
"Three fucking guesses," snarled Flick. Strike could tell that Jimmy was debating which tack to take with her. His thuggishly handsome face showed irritation, but also, Strike thought, a certain wariness. For a second time he tried to put his arm around her. This time, she slapped it away.
"Oi!"
he said again, this time aggressively.
"The fuck was that for?"
"I'm off doing your dirty work, and you're fucking around with her. What kind of fucking idiot do you think I am, Jimmy?"
"Missiles out!"
bellowed a steward with a megaphone, and the crowd took up the chant once more. The cries made by the Mohicaned woman beside Strike were as shrill and raucous as a peacock's. The one bonus of the renewed shouting was that it left Strike at liberty to grunt with pain every time he set his prosthetic foot on the road, which was a kind of release and made the plastic mask reverberate in a ticklish fashion against his sweating face. Squinting through the eyeholes, he watched Jimmy and Flick argue, but he couldn't hear a word over the din of the crowd. Only when the chant subsided at last could he make out a little of what they were saying to each other.
"I'm fucking sick of this," Jimmy was saying. "I'm not the one who picks up students in bars when..." "You ditched me," said Flick, in a kind of whispered scream. "You fucking ditched me. You told me you didn't want anything exclusive. Heat of the moment, wasn't it?"
said Jimmy roughly.
"I was stressed. Billy was doing my fucking head in. I didn't expect you to go straight to a bar and pick up some fucking... You told me you were sick of... Fuck's sake. I lost my temper and said a bunch of shit I didn't mean. If I went and shagged another woman every time you give me grief... Yeah, well, I sometimes think the only reason you keep me around is chiz. Keep your fucking voice down. And today, you think it was fun at that creep's house? I said I was grateful, fuck's sake. We discussed this, didn't we? I had to get those leaflets printed or I'd have come with you. And I do that cleaning,"
she said with a sudden sob.
"And it's disgusting. And then today you send me... It was horrible, Jimmy. He should be in hospital. He's in a right state."
Jimmy glanced around. Coming briefly within Jimmy's eyeline, Strike attempted to walk naturally, though every time he asked his stump to bear his full weight, he felt as though he was pressing it down on 1,000 fire ants.
"We'll get him to hospital after," said Jimmy. "We will. But he'll screw it all up if we let him loose now. You know what he's like. Once Wynne's got those photos." "Hey,"
said Jimmy gently, putting his arm around her for a third time.
"Listen, I'm so fucking grateful to you."
"Yeah,"
choked Flick, wiping her nose on the back of her hand.
"Because of the money. Because you wouldn't even know what Chisel had done if..."
Jimmy pulled her roughly towards him and kissed her. For a second, she resisted, then opened her mouth. The kiss went on and on as they walked. Strike could see their tongues working in each other's mouths. They staggered slightly as they walked, locked together, while other core members grinned. and the girl whom Jimmy had lifted into the air looked crestfallen. "Jimmy," murmured Flick at last, when the kiss had